and welcome to the Innovation Forum podcast for Friday, 18th September, with me, Ian Welsh. At Innovation Forum's recent Ethical Trade and Human Rights Conference, JTI's International Affairs Director, Elaine Mackay, explained to my colleague Toby Webb how focus on growers has helped the business understand farm labour challenges, including child labour, and enable the company to work with farmers and deliver on its Sustainable Development Goals commitments. Coming up, we have some highlights of their fascinating conversation. First up, though, is the usual roundup of some sustainable business news. The Science Based Targets Initiative has revealed guidance on what will become a standard to ensure corporate targets and net zero ambitions are based in science. The snappily titled Foundations for Science-Based Net Zero Target Setting in the Corporate Sector paper has been released with input from CDP, UN Global Compact, World Resources Initiative, and WWF. A broader group of stakeholders, including business representatives, were also consulted. The resulting standard is hoped to provide concrete help to companies to set net zero emissions targets. 970 companies have now committed to science-based targets. Big tech companies continue to vie for environmental credentials, with the announcements that both Facebook and Google are becoming carbon neutral. Google has retrospectively offset its carbon emissions dating back to the company's founding in 1998, and says it will be powered exclusively by renewable energy by 2030. Facebook will meet a 100% renewable target this year for its own operations and is committed to net zero emissions for its entire value chain by 2030. Microsoft has already announced its plans for carbon negativity by 2030 and to offset all historical emissions by 2050. Apple announced recently its route to carbon neutrality by 2030, which includes its entire supply chain and, moreover, the life cycle of all its products, including power used by devices, laptops and mobile phones. Tech watchers point out that Amazon is now noticeably lagging behind. Last year, it announced targets for net zero emissions, but by 2040, and 100% renewable energy by 2030. And it's not just the tech sector that's making big promises. Food giant Smithfield Foods, based in Virginia in the US, but with operations worldwide, has committed to being carbon negative in all operations in the US by 2030, and to doing this without resorting to purchasing carbon credits to offset emissions. This is the first such commitment from a major protein company. Previously in 2016, Smithfield had set a goal of reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 25% by 2025. The company will get to carbon negativity through improved fertiliser efficiencies and soil health practices, and through renewable energy generation and projects. New research by CDP points a finger at the fashion industry, accusing the majority of the sector's top companies of failing to adequately respond to investor concerns over supply chain water risks. Released in the run-up to London Fashion Week, CDP's report says that the apparel and textile sector is responsible for significant water pollution throughout the supply chain, including runoff from fields, toxic chemicals in creating and finishing garments, and then from microfiber pollution from consumer laundering of clothing. There are some businesses CDP highlights as demonstrating awareness of water pollution risks, including Gap, H&M and Kering. However, out of the 136 companies asked by investors in 2019 for water pollution impact assessments, only 62 provided any data. The New Zealand government has announced that it will be the first nation to require the financial sector to report on climate-related risk, with the aim of bringing climate resilience into the core of financial and business decision-making. The rules will require companies to report on a disclosure-comply basis, based on the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures framework. Businesses will have to make annual disclosures that cover governance arrangements, risk management, and strategy for mitigating climate change impacts. If companies are unable to make these disclosures, then they must explain why. Around 200 companies will be within the new requirement scope, and we'll need to make such disclosures. Innovation Forum's 2020 Future of Plastics Conference will be held via our interactive online platform over 3 days from the 20th to the 22nd of October. Among the expert panellists already confirmed are representatives of Coca-Cola European Partners, Dow Chemical Company, Tesco, Anheuser-Busch InBev and Greenpeace. And the first week of November this year sees Innovation Forum's Sustainable Landscapes and Commodities event. This will include a series of focused interactive workshops around an extended conference over 3 days from the 3rd to the 5th of November. Already signed up to take part are senior representatives from Sime Darby, April, Tate & Lyle, WWF, Burger King and the Consumer Goods Forum. And all details are on innovationforum.co.uk. We have a workshop coming up on the 8th of October exclusively for conference delegates. We will consider the next generation of smallholder farmers and what we require to empower them. Sign up for the November event now to attend the October workshop, and if you register before 18th September, you can get £150 saving on full event passes. A few weeks ago, Innovation Forum's Toby Webb spoke with JTI's International Affairs Director Elaine Mackay at our Ethical Trade and Human Rights Conference online. They talked about agriculture supply chain child labour issues, the importance of recognising the complexity of the challenges, and the need for agri-sector businesses to get to know their suppliers.
why don't you start by framing the challenge of child labour in your industry? Because not everybody will be familiar with the intricacies of the tobacco sector. I'm guessing predominantly in Africa, but also elsewhere. So it'd be interesting to hear from you just to frame the challenge as it currently exists, and then we can move into talking about how you've been tackling that through various programs and some of the issues that arise from that and opportunities.
I work for a company called Japan Tobacco International, and tobacco is at the forefront of what we do. What is interesting is that we employ around 45,000 people. We operate in more than 120 countries. And some people recognize our brands before they recognize the company. But a few years ago, I think in 2009, our company realized that in order to be at the forefront of our company, we needed security of leaf supply. If you imagine you're dealing with an agricultural commodity, a storm, some kind of climatic event can significantly interrupt that security of supply. So JTI made the decision to purchase leaf dealers and what we call vertically integrate. What it took, though, was JTI, who was largely a procurer of tobacco leaf, so we would buy the supplies that we leave, the manufacturer of leaf and distributor of tobacco product, it became now much more about the grower. We bought companies that gave us a footprint in Africa, as you can imagine, but we also buy a lot of leaf in the US, Brazil, and actually the footprint for leaf is more than 33 countries. So from Southeast Asia all the way to the US. When we got so close to the grower, we realized that the outside world sees our employment not at 45,000 people, but see the grower as our employee also. The duty of care, as people defined it, was frightening because people said we were responsible for the grower. But the grower is contracted to us. We don't have an employment contract with him. We have a contractor agreement, which he undergoes in order to grow the leaf that we need at the right quality and at the price that is good for both of us. But it means that we've virtually doubled our employee base from 45,000 to more than today, 45,000 directly contracted growers. So if you imagine a world where people think that a farmer is our employee, how much more do they think we are responsible for? At the same time, the world was changing and the UN guiding principles were being ratified. And these principles were saying, well, you don't need to just know what's happening in your factories and in your manufacturing footprint. You need to know what's happening in the second and third tier of your supply chain. That took us again right back to the grower, having to know at a much deeper level, which are the challenges he's facing economically, environmentally, and in terms of labor. And the UN guiding principles say that you mustn't just know what your issues are. You need a plan to fix them. And anyone that participated in the last 2 days of the conference will be very clear that more and more, the UN guiding principles are now being embedded in national action plans. So in the Netherlands, for example, has embedded in their law compulsory human rights or mandatory human rights due diligence insofar as the rights of the child is concerned. And that's what companies like ours are now responsible for. So the first message is, if you procure an agricultural commodity, you have a problem with child labor. That's one of the lessons. You don't need to do human rights due diligence to understand the scale of the problem. If you're buying cocoa, sugar, tea, anything that comes from the ground, you have a problem because you have a problem with labor. And when you run a factory, it's fine. You can control access. You can control and verify age. Because if they're on your payroll, they'll give you an identity document to prove who they are. On the farm, it doesn't work in the same way. Yet the expectations from the UN guiding principles and the law are becoming more and more aligned. And that's the challenge. When you deal with an agricultural commodity, someone has to harvest the crop. Labor is a challenge. And that's why child labor is so pronounced. Child labor is an issue in agriculture. And that's one of the key messages that has to come out.
So an interesting follow-up question for that. In the previous session, I was going to outline the worst human rights dilemma I'd seen poor farmers facing as an example of the complexity of the issues. And for me, the most difficult dilemma I've ever seen families facing was stories I heard of when I was in West Africa, northern Côte d'Ivoire, families from places like Burkina Faso, there were lots of children, effectively selling children into slavery on cocoa farms across the border in order to keep them alive because the harvest had failed. They knew they couldn't feed their children. I mean, that's the worst ethical dilemma I've ever heard anyone had to face. They'd actually interviewed some of the children on the farms. I mean, CNN actually did a big documentary about it 10 years ago. One of the more in-depth ones I've seen media do. Normally it's kind of, you know, blame the brands. And the children were being interviewed and saying, well, you know, if I wasn't here working as basically bonded labour on a cocoa farm in northern Cote d'Ivoire, I probably wouldn't starve to death. And the stats indicated that north of the border. That's one of the dilemmas that poor families face in the cocoa sector. Admittedly, not in every part, but in some areas. And I wondered if families in tobacco are facing those kind of really stark economic choices, or whether the issues are less challenging than that, but they're more kind of endemic in the culture of where they are. So just maybe you could give us an overview of, not the worst examples, but the kind of challenges that poor farmers are facing and the choices they have to make that can lead to some of these issues happening in the supply chain. Just kind of bring it to life a bit.
Absolutely. And what you're describing is understanding what the root cause of the problem is. And that's what we pay a lot of attention to in our fight against child labor, because otherwise you're putting a plaster on a band-aid. You have to understand what is driving children to seek work in hazardous conditions in agriculture. Two of the root causes we've discovered, one is poverty. People are poor and they want to make sure that they can eat. It's as simple as that. The other one is culture. So the means to deal with both of those root causes is completely different. If the root cause of child labor is poverty, you need to make sure that people earn enough money to send their kids to school. You need to replace income that was lost when a child is now at school. In terms of culture, you need to change the way people think about children. In Brazil, for example, the biggest sustainability issue is kids don't want to be farmers. So they leave Rio Grande do Sul and move to São Paulo or Rio because they're looking for something else for themselves. Now that poses a challenge. And in Brazil, you cannot work on a tobacco farm if you're under 18. So farmers are more inclined to use their kids because they want the kids to love the land. Both approaches require dialogue. Both approaches require us working with community members and farmers specifically to help them change the way they see children. Because it's not just about saying, here's $100, go to school for the year. How is the child going to eat when you've taken that income away, for example? What kind of support is available to the child? So what we do is embed the rights of the child in direct contracts with growers. So they are aware what our standard is. That's the first thing. Our standard, though, is very clear, but we will not cancel the contract on the first occurrence of child labor. When we've identified it, we then work with the grower to change the circumstance for that child. Because as you say, for many kids, you will leave them worse off. You leave family members worse off if the contract is simply canceled. That's not a viable strategy. What we've also discovered is that when you do due diligence, that is done the correct way. You listen to the rights holder. So often due diligence is done sitting in a beautiful office in Geneva or Stockholm. And it's just a tick the box exercise. Yes, we've done it. The risk to the business is high. Climate change, labor issues. No, that's not the way it works. You have to have conversations with rights holders. And when you listen to them, it's easier to come up with solutions that will benefit them ultimately. So in Malawi, a farmer says to me, education makes you poor. I had never heard that before. Because kids go to school because parents believe the return on investment will come. I went to the school. There's more than 200 kids in a class. The teacher is ill-equipped to teach 200 kids. Often no electricity, no running water, 40 degrees outside. That's what he sees.
It's a minimal learning environment, isn't it, really, at best?
Absolutely. So what our strategy then encompasses is withdrawal of children from child labor and then making sure that these kids are actually attending a school that's safe, empowering teachers, building the capacity, and actually building and refurbishing schools so that you can reduce that pupil-teacher ratio.
If you look at a lot of smallholder agriculture, we spend a lot of time in other commodities wringing our hands about how young people don't want to stay on the farms, but then also wringing our hands about child labor. Where do you draw the line on definitions here? I'll give you an example. I heard years ago, this may have changed, that the minimum legal age for working on family-owned farms in the US at one point was 11 years old. And when I was 13 years old, growing up in rural Somerset, I was driving a tractor and I worked in fields when I was 13 or 14 for piece rate, picking fruit and vegetables. That's what we did, because the only other job was McDonald's, and we'd much rather be out in the fields earning tax-free money. It's very easy to get caught up in the sort of media hysteria about what is child labour. But when you talk about embedding the rights of the child into contracts, how do you work with the cultural challenges of defining what is a child in an appropriate context?
Very good question. Because I was 9 years old when I could pick and bale cotton on a cotton farm in Swaziland. The key difference is it didn't interfere with my ability to attend school. And that's the difference between child labour and child work. it's embedded in our contract and specified by age, and we get our age ranges from the ILO's conventions on minimum age and the worst forms of child labor. And in fact, what we say in our contracts is that our standard will prevail even when the law offers a lower standard of protection. So you're right. In the US, on family farms, 13-year-olds are driving the tractors. And if you go up to the farmer and say, your child shouldn't be doing this, it's like, who do you think you are telling me what my child can and can't do? But that's, in our contract, that's hazardous work for a child. When they are legally able to work, when they are appropriately trained and protected, then we can discuss whether or not a child can do hazardous work. So the first thing we do is make sure a farmer understands the difference between child work and child labor, because we're not trying to tell them how to raise their children. You know, yeah. I have two kids. My 16-year-old has to contribute to this house by cleaning and cooking. They mustn't now all of a sudden discover that that is hazardous. But it doesn't interfere with their ability to attend school. And that's key. It must not interfere with their health and morals. So we're very clear. Where the law offers a lower standard of protection, our standard is clear. No one under the age of 18 should be involved in any hazardous activity unless the law allows it, they're appropriately trained and protected. And in some cases,
how do you define non-hazardous? Because if I go back to the cocoa farm example, I remember going to these fair trade cocoa farms with Cadbury first time I went 10 years ago. And people are sitting there, young people, young women, cocoa pod in one hand, machete in the other, bang, open it up, get the seeds out for fermentation, flesh goes for whatever purpose. There were some journalists there, and the people at Cadbury were going, oh no, they're not supposed to be doing this. They're supposed to open the cocoa pods with a stick because it's hazardous work. And all the villagers just burst out laughing and said, have you ever tried to open a cocoa pod with a stick? we could, A, you can't do it. And B, frankly, we wouldn't make any money if we did. And that was a really good example of some of the dilemmas, I thought, of how you define hazardous work. And some of the challenges were exemplified through that for me of how you actually tackle that in a rural community. So when it comes to your own example, and how are you defining hazardous work as it applies to children?
We worked with the ILO. We worked with our toxicologists and scientists to come up with our lists of hazards so that a farmer understands what we deem to be hazardous. One is carrying heavy loads. So we don't use machetes to harvest tobacco, fortunately. That's a good one. But you carry heavy loads. Mm-hmm. And comparatively speaking, I mean, we have a range. So the bag should not weigh more than 10% of the child. For example, I even check my own kids' school bags to make sure that they're not carrying heavy loads. Working at heights is hazard. Working at night is a hazard. So what we've specified is very clear in the contract. So the farmer understands what we need to be a hazard. There are those who think, for example, that all work with tobacco is hazard. That's not the case. There are some activities that kids can do as long as it doesn't interfere with their ability to attend school. So they can, for example, help out at home. They can mow the lawn. But we do not want kids carrying heavy loads. We don't want kids operating heavy machinery. We don't want them working long hours. And we definitely don't want them working at night.
Let's talk about then how successful that is on the ground. I'm guessing a lot of your smallholder farmers are not terribly well off given the environments they're operating in. Tobacco is often a higher value crop than many others. So they might not be the region's poorest farmers, but they're not making loads. So how do you get that across on the ground? And are those kind of approaches seeing results? Do farmers listen, I suppose, is what I'm saying. And what evidence do you have? How do you kind of monitor the fact that they might be listening or not?
So, Toby, they wouldn't listen to you. Who do they listen to? It's our leaf technicians. So we have one leaf technician for every 100 growers. And they are trained on good agricultural practices. So the farmer knows the quality that he needs to grow to fetch the highest price. In addition to good agricultural practices, we've taught our leaf technicians to observe labor practices, health and safety standards on farms. They're now able to ask workers whether they have freedom of association, as an example. We've taught them how to observe child labor. And that's an interesting one, because it's easier to see a child on a farm. You can differentiate simply by size between an adult and a child. And then to have a conversation with the grower to say, this is in violation of our standards. Why is this child here? Mm-hmm. Farmers are beginning to understand that if they send their child to school, they can employ adults to work. The quality of the leaf is better. Because I don't know, people listening, if you have kids and you tell them to go and bake, your kitchen is a disaster. Children working in an area does not necessarily deem quality. So farmers are realizing good agricultural practices plus good labor practices, mm-hmm. better quality. Better quality means better price. So you're right. the price paid on tobacco is much higher than any other food crop. So that's their cash crop. And they want to make the most money so that it can allow them to pay school fees, buy machinery and equipment. And the stories, even though they're smallholder farmers, that we get are incredible. Malawi, when we started, their yields were 600 kilograms per hectare, doubled without changing now the size of the land. How do you do it? Good agricultural practices and good labor practices. So they see the return on investment.
As ever, there's plenty more insight and analysis available on innovationforum.co.uk, including the usual audio, interviews and podcasts. Out this week is some analysis on waste recycling and how businesses can help drive improvements on plastics in particular. But that's all for now. I've been Ian Welsh, and I'll be back next week.